Good evening. So, you've been here before. One time. Yeah, I can't remember your name. Vicki. Let's do introductions around.
Wendy. Judy.
Jeffrey.
Nico.
Yeah.
Harley.
Haven't seen you for a while.
Well, this 1 week.
Yeah.
It seems like a while.
Well, it was a boiled down experience, you could say. So we're come to the end of the Platform Sutra. This is sort of saying goodnight to Huineng tonight. He keeps saying, I'm going, and everybody says, oh, we're so sorry. But then he keeps saying, I'm going some more. So these last couple of chapters are mostly one of his students explaining what that he had kept the whole thing going and his pride in being able to sustain the teaching and pass it on. But there is one bit in here that besides one bit else, this last long poem that he wrote, he said to them, the liberation of seeing the real Buddha of your nature is the total message that he's been talking about all along. It's not the real Buddha. It's the real Buddha of your nature. Not somebody else's. That's the crucial part of this. He said, I won't read the whole thing. He talks about the Nirmanakaya and the Sambhogakaya again, the different ways of talking about the body of Buddha as aspects of mind, really, more than Nirmanakaya as the body of us, but Sambhogakaya and Dharmakaya as the bigger aspects of mind. but he says they're all one thing, just different ways of talking about what you find when you search inside yourself. He said, the nature of defilement, people are always worried about purity and badness of some kind, the negative and the positive. And very often people come to practice wanting to rub away all the bad stuff and become pure and faultless. And he says the nature of defilement is the cause of purity. There is no pure body in the absence of defilement. It's another one of those black and white, up and down, in and out, war and peace. It defines, they define each other. You can't have one without the other. It's really important to understand that, because it's how our mind works. But if we don't realize it, we actually begin to think that one side or the other is true. It's only true in a relative way. It's all provisional. Including your defilement, which is defining your purity.
So what does defilement mean?
You're being dirtied.
Okay.
But just being distorted and wrong.
Got it.
Yeah. So we're all distorted and wrong. We can't possibly get it right. It's too complicated, and we're too simple-minded, I would say, mostly, even though we're all brilliant geniuses in many ways. And that's another one of those things. It's both. We're both. So the more we struggle against our nature, either the genius side or the idiot side, the more frustrated we get and the more out of touch with the way things really are. We practice and clarity comes as we see that, oh, it's not just this, it's that, and that, and maybe even another something. That there are so many causes and conditions, so many different ways that form takes, that catch our eye and our attention and our emotion. We're constantly being stirred by the things that come to us, but they're going away at the same time. It's all coming and all going. He said, just keep your nature free of the five desires. The moment you see your nature, it is real. The five desires are for food, shelter, sex, oh, that's terrible, I can't remember them.
Safety. Safety.
No.
Safety one.
No.
Electronics.
Electronics. It'll come to me in a minute.
friends, connections.
He goes on to say, if the direct teaching makes sense to you, this life, makes sense to you in this life, you will understand before you is a Buddha. In other words, what you meet is Buddha. If you try to find a Buddha through your practice, I wonder where you'll find one that's real. You can't go out and find Buddha. Right here already. If you can find something real inside yourself, this something real is the cause of Buddhahood. Don't look for a Buddha outside what is real. All those who go in search for one are fools. The last little verse is, this direct teaching came here from the West, but liberating others is up to you to practice. I urge you, students of the way today, don't act so depressed when you hear this. That's such a funny last message. But it's also cogent, especially now. I think it's easy to feel depressed by how confusing and strange the world is. But it's a very bright and fine thing, clarity. Buddha itself is our very life itself. And boy, aren't we lucky. In spite of everything, aren't we lucky? He said, I'm going to go now. Again, he says, don't engage in worldly customs of crying and accepting condolence money and wearing mourning garments. That would not be the Buddhist way, and you would not be my disciples. Buddha said the same thing to his disciples. Of course, they just cried anyway. How could they not? Act the same as if I was here. Sit together in meditation, but just stay free and at ease and at peace. After this, he spoke no more. It describes the last of his he said they took his body, they all vied to receive it, and they lit incense and decided whoever the incense smoke went to would be the place that they would take the body. And so it went to straight towards Shaoxi on the 13th day of the 11th month of funerary urn, along with the robe and bowl of the patriarchship, were returned there. In the following year of the 7th month, he was taken out of the urn. Must have been a huge urn for his whole body in there. And his disciple Fang Pian covered him with incense impregnated mud. Aware of this premonition that someone would try to steal his head, to protect the master's neck, his followers first wrapped him with a lacquered cloth that contained iron. Then they placed him inside a pagoda. Suddenly, from within the pagoda, a bright light appeared and lit the sky overhead and lasted for 3 days. And Red Pine says these urns can still be found in China today. So, been a long time doing this, meeting him and meeting him over and over and over. It's a wonderful picture of him on the cover. He was just a woodcutter. He didn't even know how to read and write. And yet, he became a great teacher. Having met the Dharma on the way. So we've come to that place that we always come to at Floating Zendo, deciding what to do next. And one of the suggestions was the precepts. And so I brought a book that I always recommend because this is such a good book on the precepts, the 10 to 16 precepts by John Dido Laurie. Of everything that we do, the precepts are probably the essence of the action of getting up from the cushion. That if they say there are aspects of our practice that we meditate, and we also need some kind of ethical standards, that it's not just meditation, it's how we embody and enact what we discover in our meditation, what Weening was just pointing to. And the precepts are very simple, very basic, and they are given and taken in our practice in Soto Zen at the drop of a hat, just about any time. As seeing the full moon, seeing the quarter moon, seeing the half moon, seeing the other quarter moon. In Buddhist time, they all got together at each phase of the moon and recited the precepts together. It was how they kept the community in sympathy, everyone with everyone. And it was an opportunity if somebody had stolen something from someone, he would confess it and apologize, so that things kept clearing up, actually right there, face to face, in the middle of everything and everybody. So the clarity we're talking about is not some spacious kind of magical state. It's being present and being completely present and conscious and willing to take in whatever it is that we have done and do, and how it is that we are with everyone. It's not sure whether this is a religion or nobody can say exactly. There's a very deep devotional side of it, but this ethical side is really powerful and important, as is the wisdom side. So wisdom and clarity and meditation, and then moral and ethical teachings. No killing, no stealing, no lying. Plain, simple. So there are many, many other things that we could study. And I was hoping we could talk about that a little bit tonight.
Another question.
Yes.
I think you've said this before, but I can't remember the reason that the early Western Buddhism didn't really emphasize the precepts as much as it did some of the more esoteric messages that made it seem lawless and kind of justifying whatever goes, or no attachment, so whatever, and I can't remember why you said that. Why did Western Buddhists kind of forget this key piece?
Well, they didn't have a teacher.
Yeah.
They were reading stuff, but there weren't any teachers in those early days. It was the beatnik time.
Right.
Before the hippie time, it was the beatnik time. And Alan Watts came out of the Episcopal Church in England and got off on Buddhism. And he was wild. He was a little bit wild. They all were a little bit wild. And there weren't any actual teachers except for D.T. Suzuki. And then little by little, the teachers began to come. Jeffrey's teacher, whose name I always forget.
Kenneth Roshi.
And was one of the very first ones. And she brought a very strong precepts set of standards to practice. And then Suzuki Roshi, and little by little, it became very clear that the folks who were sitting with Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco were, a lot of them, liberated hippies, and they still talk about it. They're old guys now and old women, and they still talk about those crazy days when they didn't know what they were doing, but they sure loved it. They didn't take care of Suzuki Roshi. They had no real respect for him, except as this magical person who just appeared in his long robes in this special kind of way. So they failed to support him, and they would crowd around him and knock on his door at 3 o'clock in the morning, and just, and people did that with Coben too, just kind of used him because he was there. And it took a while for us to realize what it was, what they were bringing to us. So it took a while, and still, you know, now they're creating all kinds of different versions of this. There's a store in New York City where you can come in and out as you will, and it's kind of set up for meditation or whatever you want to do. There are many versions of mindfulness, Zen, that certainly do not accord with the teachings in here, except they must in some way. They do in some way. I don't want to say they're not, because anybody who sits down is it. That's just it. That's all it takes, really. Just sit down and shut up and be there for a little while. It's
did that piece also tend towards this lack of structure, the fact that it's not a non-dualistic framework, also
yes,
maybe led to this lack of discipline, I guess, or
well, it's there's some who write about it who promise freedom,
yeah,
and that was the big deal, was freedom. That it was thought that it was certain that the rules that people grew up by were pretty rigid, and people didn't want to do that anymore. They didn't want to wear gloves to church, and they didn't want to wear a tie and a jacket to the opera, or they didn't want to do the things that their parents wanted them to do. So they all came to San Francisco, it seems like, and filled up Haight Ashbury for one very beautiful summer until drugs came in and everything went to hell in a basket.
But even if you're coming from a yoga perspective,
yes,
those hardcore many deities, but they're the deities.
Yes.
I've had a yoga teacher kind of scold me for, not me, but just, I don't go for that Buddhist thing where anything goes. Kind of, you know, even recently, it's not,
well,
you know, within the last 10 years, someone told me that.
Well, that is one of the understandings about Zen.
Yeah.
You know, we have a Zen perfume and a Zen everything now. And that isn't what Zen means, sitting. That's all it means.
Yeah. But it's so interesting because the precepts mean so much more to me than the Ten Commandments ever did.
Well, they're very different.
Yeah.
Yes. There's nobody from on high telling you you have to be good. It's not like that. It's reminding you of your own intention and being, allowing yourself to be surprised. Oh, I did that again. Like that. Yeah. Didn't mean to. Try not to do it again. So, are there other suggestions? Jeffrey?
So, this is a suggestion for the future, not necessarily for this conversation. But I'd really love to explore the writings and teachings of Sozan and Tozan, for whom Soto Zen.
Yes.
I think that would really be a lovely exercise for us to dabble with some of that.
We could do that.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's a very...
Thank you.
Oh, that's a great suggestion.
Who are Sozan and Tozan?
So they're, I think I'm correct, I think they're in the 800s, and Tozan is the teacher, Sozan is his mentor, and they are our ancestors. And that's where we get this. They took the first initials or syllables and created Soto.
Oh, got it. Oh, I see.
So they're in that list that we chanted last week. And there are many stories about them.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could do that. That would be fun.
Pretty deep stories.
Yes, quite. Yeah, very. They shake you. Nico?
I know that you've studied this at least twice in the past. I'd be interested in reading and studying the Heart Sutra, since we chant it every time.
Yes.
I personally found it to be a thing that spoke to me and kind of keeps me engaged in this practice. Yeah, so
it's a wonderful suggestion. There are 1,000 books written about the Heart Sutra now. And it is, of all the things that we chant, it's certainly crucial to our practice. I just did a funeral a week or so ago and remembered Koban saying that even at a funeral, chanting the Heart Sutra is a happy thing. It brings a kind of perspective to something that just seems like bam. So it's one of those good bad things again. It just brings up the other side of things in such a wonderful way.
I like the fact that it's so short yet so full.
Yes.
It's almost like taking a hit of some essence. It's really hard to, but it gets into, I found it kind of got into my brain, into my whatever.
Yes.
My soul. I don't know what the, so it just kind of keeps circulating.
Yes. It'll never go away. Right. Yeah, that's a wonderful idea. And the Dalai Lama has a great book about it. And Deshi Maru has a great book about it, and infinite number of others too.
Have you ever done the Diamond Sutra in here?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could do the Diamond Sutra again. That's what woke up.
Right, I was just thinking.
We knew.
Follow the diamonds.
Yes.
Follow
them. Yes. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. Short? Short?
Sorry.
Not as short as the Heart Sutra, but short. Well, last time we voted. Shall we vote? What do the rest of you think?
We do them all.
Well, yes, we should do them all. One by one. Anybody have druthers about which one first?
You pick.
I think we did study the Heart Sutra within the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been quite a while since we studied the precepts.
Yeah.
And they're pretty foundational. Also.
Also, for anyone considering Jukai, it's a marvelous, I think, thing to do. So
it's true. It's essential.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely essential.
Yeah.
So I'm coming up on my 40th year, so I'd really love to do a Jukai.
40th year.
For
40th year.
For each year. For 40 years of Buddhist practice, yeah. So I'd really like to do a Jukai for 2018. So if we do precepts.
Yes.
I'd really love to do an anniversary Jukai. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Somebody explain what is a Jukai?
It's an offering from your teacher of the precepts in which you receive them. You accept them. And it's a very small ceremony, but it is a ceremony that is very, very sweet. And you can sew one of these.
That's a pretty, although
that one's pretty fancy.
Isn't that fancy? I had to wear it. It just came to me from Jane McDonald.
Oh my goodness.
She made it.
Oh my goodness.
It is
She's
so.
She's been working on that for 10 years.
Who's been working on that?
Jane McDonald.
Oh, wow.
Who came after Sashin. Nehani Sashin, she came to visit. She lives in Canada. Maybe you won't hear.
So making one of these is a practice, and you do that before you do the take the precepts.
Does it take 10 years?
Hmm?
Does it take 10 years?
Some people take 10 years. Some people can do it in a week. Just depends.
You can also buy them online.
Not in our lineage.
That's the fourth defilement. Online shopping for you.
Yeah.
What is the fifth defilement?
I think we did do the Diamond Sutra within the last 7 years for those of us with long numbers. And I think this is a very appropriate time to do the precepts, not just for Jeffers. There's any time a good time. But I just feel like the situation in the world and the country is really a good time to review them.
I see what you mean. Thank you. Yeah. Good point. Anybody else?
I second that.
Shall we vote?
Sure.
All right. What? Heart Sutra? Diamond Sutra? Sure. So I should make a list of this. Well, I'll make a list when I get home. Heart Sutra, Diamond Sutra, Precepts.
Precepts. Precepts.
I guess, is there something else in there?
Jeffrey's suggestions.
Oh, yeah, Soto.
So that's for the somewhere down the line.
I'll put that together, though, because I think that's very interesting to consider for us.
I probably have something to say about the precepts somewhere.
I know there's a lot of go on work with those two.
That's interesting. There's something. What is that? Okay.
Is it 8 o'clock? It is 8 o'clock. Yes. Are there announcements? Yes, we're having an all-day sit on Saturday, starting at 9 o'clock, and breaking for lunch, Dharma talk at 1, Doksans in the morning, and ending at 4. So, come one and all.
I'll be glad to open up. I have a funeral to attend Saturday.
Oh gosh.
But I'll be glad to open it all up.
Marie's opening.
Oh,
Marie's
she's opening. Already got a key?
I mailed it to her today.
Okay. Okay, then.
No, thank you anyway.
Yeah. Thank you anyway. That's here.
Here, yes. Yeah.